Let's begin. If you could each tell me your name, how old you are, and where you're from. Okay, what's your name?
Sam.
Sam from where?
Melbourne.
How old are you?
18.
Okay.
Gideon Katz from Melbourne, 18.
This is Nathanael, he lives here in Israel. Yosef here in Israel. Yeah. Daniel, where are you from? Where?
Perth.
Which is where?
In Australia.
And how old are you?
17.
Okay.
Michael from Cape Town.
South Africa.
I'm 19.
Okay, my name is Nathanael Frengenthal. I was born here. I grew up in the United States. And we're going to be studying Brit Milah today, but first I want to begin with a story. The poor girl desperately wanted to marry this guy, and her parents insisted no. And in those days, when parents said no, there was no two ways about it, and she argued and she pleaded and she tried explaining to them how much she loved them, but they wouldn't listen. And as she argued more, it reached a point where her father took her before the king, and the king said to her, "Lady, are you going to marry this guy?" And she says, "He is the love of my life." And the king says, "Well, you have two choices. Either you agree to marry someone else, or we're going to put you in jail." And she insists, and they put her in jail for 7 years in solitary confinement. And for 7 years in solitary confinement, she writes love letters. She writes a whole book about why she loves him, about why she won't marry anyone but him. And at the end of the 7 years, the king takes her out and says, "Listen here, you have two choices. Either give up on him or die." And she says, "I won't give up." Let's fast forward. She's crossed the deserts. She's stood up against torture and the death penalty. And finally she marries him. And one day someone sees her with the wedding ring on her finger and he says, "I know why you wear that ring. You wear that ring in case someone starts up with you and you punch him in the face. So it should be a harder punch, so you should have that ring." And she looks at that ring and she says, "You don't even know what's behind this ring. You don't know how much I put into this ring. You have no idea what I did to get married to this guy." Well, the girl we're talking about is Avraham Avinu, our patriarch. And he was tortured and he was put in solitary confinement for years. He was put in a prison in darkness where he was told that when they take him out of darkness after 4 years straight, into broad daylight, he would go blind. And during those 4 years, he sat and compiled the work on monotheism. And he crossed deserts, and he put up with wars for his belief in monotheism. And then God gave him a covenant, a connection between him and God. And people today have the goal to say, that's in order to protect you from AIDS. That's like telling the guy, "You're wearing that ring because you want to sack someone in the face. That's not why we do the circumcision." We're going to discuss later today why circumcisions are beneficial in preventing the spread of AIDS, why the UN funded people going, circumcisers going down and circumcising millions of people in Africa to prevent the spread of AIDS. Even though it's not 100%, it helps a lot. But that's not why God gave us the mitzvah. God gave us a covenant. God gave us a covenant that we've been killed and tortured, and we put up with every challenge under the planet, and not given up on that covenant, because we are the people of God. And I want us to take a journey back in time. Let's imagine that we were all there when God took us out of Egypt. So we call a meeting and we say, "Look, we witnessed the Ten Commandments. We witnessed the Exodus from Egypt. We witnessed the great miracles of the Ten Plagues." And I turn to Daniel and I say, "Daniel, I want an idea. You know, to us it's perfectly clear what happened and that God runs the show. But how are we going to pass it on to the future generations? You know, there's going to be a time where they're going to have iPods and iPhones and all kinds of things. And then the kids are going to look at it and say, 'Come on, you got to be kidding. 10 plagues. How are we going to keep this alive and real?'" And Daniel suggests that we make a hat that says, "I left Egypt. I am a monotheist." And everyone from now on for generations is going to wear that hat. And Michael says, that's not enough. Come on, I'm in South Africa. We all wear hats. We all have our teams and everything. I want us to each have a flag outside our house that says, I'm a monotheist. I believe in it. God took us out of Egypt. And then Benji. What's your real name?
Benjamin.
Okay. Benjamin says, no, that's not enough. You know, yeah, a flag people can take down, a hat people can take off. We got to do something more. So Benjamin says, we have to have a declaration every morning, every night, monotheism, and God took us out of Egypt. And we're thinking, what can we do, you know? So we turn to Anthony, and Anthony says, we got to do one better. Anthony says, you know, there was the plague of the firstborn, which was the culmination. Let's do something with firstborns to make it special. And we're thinking. Sam says, no, that's not enough. We need that everyone who came out of Egypt cuts off their nose. You know, you see every person with the front of their nose missing. It's going to be very clear. I didn't do this for nothing. I did this because something special happened. And Daniel says, you guys missed one very, very important point. What about the anniversary, the actual day when it happened? If we don't do something on that day, how will people keep it? How will people realize? Now, if you think about it for a minute, what's the most powerful thing among all of these? To my mind, it's Sam's suggestion, cutting off the front of the nose, right? That's something which you wouldn't do if it wasn't real, right? So Sam says, okay, let's apply all of these, right? What was our suggestion? A hat, a shirt, a flag. So we do that. We wear tefillin. What does it say in the tefillin? It says, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. God is singular. God took us out of Egypt. What else do we do? We don't have a flag outside our doors. What do we have? We have a mezuzah that says the declaration of monotheism. What else do we do? We have a special mitzvah on the anniversary of that night. We tell our kids, this is what happened tonight, Pesach, coming right up, right? What else do we do? We take our child, and he's 8 days old, and we do a circumcision. And to my mind, if there's one thing that really shows the strength of the Jewish people, it's this fantastic mitzvah, where a parent can take a baby who's 8 days old, and today we know there are tremendous medical benefits to it. We'll discuss why Jews almost never have cancer down there, and the reason is because of the circumcision. And we'll discuss many medical benefits, which today we know from the circumcision. But again, that's like saying, yeah, you're wearing that ring in order to stalk a guy in the face. That's not why we do it. We were given a covenant. We were given a pact of love between God and us. And that's what we're doing. And that's what the circumcision represents. You know, every culture in the world, to the best of my knowledge, when people get engaged, they give a sign of their love. You give a ring. You guys heard of the Navy SEALs? You heard of the Navy SEALs, right? So the Navy SEALs have a special tattoo that only the Navy SEALs have. In Israel also, the top group in the army also has a special tattoo, even though it's a biblical prohibition to put on a tattoo, but I guess they didn't realize that. Sharon has one. We have a neighbor across the street who came to me on the eve of Yom Kippur, and he shows me his tattoo. And he says to me, you know what this is? I didn't know. And then he told me that's because I and Sharon, and started telling me what brigade he fought in, a guy across the street. And he said, do I fast Yom Kippur? Started explaining to me, I had open heart surgery this past a week earlier. Is he supposed to fast? We do things that are irrevocable to show dedication, which is irrevocable. And God gave us a mitzvah of a bris milah, which is irrevocable, and it is a tremendous sign of our connection to Hashem, and it's something we keep in private, right? It's not like cutting off the top of our nose. Today we understand tremendous medical benefits, but that's not why we do it. So we have Avraham Avinu, and God tells him, I want you to be whole. That's a pretty big statement. You know, he's spent almost 100 years doing everything he could in God's command, living up to every test as we started discussing earlier, and suddenly God says, I want you to be whole. What does God want? God tells him, you have a little extra skin. And we're going to discuss in a minute, anatomically, what is a bris milah, how is a child born, and how we do bris milah today. But we have to understand that when we do bris milah, the view that Hashem gave us of the Bris Milah, the perspective Hashem gave us, is that a person has an extra piece of skin, and when he removes it, that's when he is whole. Today, the medical benefits are so clear that throughout the United States and throughout much of Europe, if parents don't specify otherwise, the hospitals will automatically circumcise the baby. There are many states in the United States where they do it automatically. But we've been doing it long before we understood the medical benefits. And like every operation, there is a certain element of risk. You never know how it's going to heal. And there is a potential. Every so often a child does have an infection. And children have died from a bris milah. It's not a game. You know, we're doing something serious here. And although, yes, it's medically beneficial. And yes, we do thousands a day and children don't die. But we all understand that when you're wounding a person, there's always a chance of a wound becoming infected. And there is a certain element of risk involved in every bris milah, right? So what do we know about bris milah? So let's go around the room and see what every person can tell us they know about a bris milah. And while we do that, Netanel, could you get me the markers and the eraser for the blackboard? Okay, I don't know your name. What's your name?
Josh.
How old are you and where are you from?
18, Sydney.
Okay. Tell me, what can you tell me? What do you know about a bris milah?
Done when a child's 8 days old.
8 days old, excellent. What else do you know about bris milah? Sam?
Take off the foreskin.
Okay, very good. Gidon, it's going to get harder when we get to you guys, yeah? It is commanded from God. That's true. Anthony. We skipped you, Yeshua. Help us out. You guys know the story. If there was ever a man who was the man of the hour, Moshe Rabbeinu was en route to save the whole Jewish people, but he delayed. Thank you very much. He delayed in circumcising his son, and he was almost killed en route because he delayed. So you think, hey, how can the world manage without Moshe? And God sent us a message. Yeah, but the world can't manage without my covenant either. So as important as Moshe is, if he delayed the circumcision, although he had a good reason, he figured, I better go save the Jewish people, God said, no. Nah, you should have left your wife and kid behind and done the circumcision. Yeah, Anthony.
It's done by a moel.
Okay. Okay. Benjamin. Child is given a name at a brit, just like Avram Avinu, when he had his circumcision, God changed his name from Avram to Avraham. We too name a child at a brit milah. Netanel, what can you tell us about a brit milah? You could do it in Hebrew if it's easier. I'll translate. No, tamam. Kol halacha shata yoda, anything you know about a brit milah. Huh? Ma shetomal zetov. Say something, you know. Anything. You'll think. Yosef, what?
Eliyahu
comes to Bris Milah. We have a special chair for Eliyahu. That's true. Maybe we'll get to discuss why that's so. Yeah. What else is there? Well, do we fast at a Bris Milah? There's a Sudat Mitzvah, right. We have a special meal at a Brit Milah. Can you think of anything? Or they finished everything? What? What? Oh, I don't feel, I can't, I'm embarrassed to speak in front of the Rav. I definitely won't call on the Rav. Okay. So the Rav says, Israel belongs to the circumcised. There's even in the Kabbalah it says you're not supposed to circumcise Arabs, and that the reason the Arabs are the ones that always give us trouble over the land of Israel is because they also circumcised. So we have a tradition that over there, with that covenant, God said, I'm making a pact with you and I'm giving you the land of Israel. We're short on time, that's why we didn't look at the text ourselves. If we had more time, we would actually learn the text as well. Yes, Michael, you have the hardest job.
But, I think there's some law saying that a father can't give his son, his firstborn son.
No, so we say there's a mitzvah. Really, it is a mitzvah for each of you to circumcise your own sons. So now you're going to know how to do it. You ready? Okay, let's begin. What's a circumcision? So we said a child has to be 8 days old. I got a phone call this week. Parent tells me his son was born. True story. Now, this past Thursday, 5:10. Shkia is 5:18. So we count 8 days. Pretty simple. The baby's born Thursday. Okay. Thursday's day one, right? The day he was born. If it would have been nightfall already, so in Judaism, Shabbos begins on the night between Friday and Shabbos. Yom Kippur begins on the night, right? Everything in Judaism begins on the night. We don't start at midnight. We start right at sunset. So Thursday before sunset, the baby's born. Very good. So Thursday is day one. What day of the week should the bris be next week? If it's 8 days, Thursday, Friday, Shabbos, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. 8 days puts us on the same day of the week, assuming he was born in the daylight hours, or had he been born within the from the night where the day begins. Very good. So I ask the father, and this is important, I want you guys to remember this, because not every mohel asks this, and that's why you guys have to know it. I ask the father, what happened at the delivery? Was there anything unique? So he says, no, everything was great. I say, I understand everything was great. Was the child ever with any difficulties? Were there any medical issues? So he tells me, yeah, he was put in an incubator for a few hours. I say, yeah, why was he put in an incubator for a few hours? He had difficulty breathing for the first short time, but they said it was all okay. I said, oh, really? So then he had difficulty breathing. I went and spoke to the doctors, and they were concerned. His breathing and saturation levels were low. What does that mean? That means that halachically, for the first hour and a half after he was born, he was considered ill, not completely healthy, right? So the halacha tells us that although a child has to be circumcised on the eighth day, what would happen if on the eighth day he had a fever? We don't do circumcision when a child's unhealthy. And what happens if he was ill for the first hour and a half after he was born? So then there's a very special halacha that says the following. Ordinarily, when a child's born on Thursday, I count 8 days. Next Thursday from the morning you can do a bris, right? When's a bris done? By day or night? Day. A bris that's done by night is not kosher. So ordinarily, I could do the bris anytime on Thursday, right? Even though he was born Thursday afternoon, from the morning of the following Thursday, 8 days later, I could do the bris whenever I want. But when the child was ill, so then the halacha says you have to wait 7 24-hour periods to ensure that he is healthy before you do the bris. So what does that mean? The child only became healthy at 6:30 the night of Thursday, which is already Friday. 7 24-hour periods brings me into this week Friday, 6:30. Well, this week Friday, 6:30, this week Thursday, 6:30, I can't do a bris. It's night already. So his bris is Friday. This coming Friday, it's a shame we're having a bris, not here. But so he didn't think to tell me, and the mohel won't necessarily ask you. So you have to know that if there's a medical issue, you have to ask the mohel or ask your rabbi, is this a medical issue that I have to wait 7 24-hour periods for? And then let's say the baby would have been born Thursday morning at 6 o'clock, and then he got better at 7:30 or at 10:30 or 12:30. I once had a bris on Friday where the baby was sick. He was born Friday morning. He only became well at Friday 12:30 in the afternoon. So then halachically, they could not do the bris until after 12:30 on that Friday. No one wants to do a bris after 12:30 Friday afternoon. You don't have that much time to Shabbos. That's it. No, they didn't have a choice. It was a bris here, actually. Okay, so that's halacha. You guys have to know because it happens and the mohel doesn't always ask. Okay, so what is...
Yeah? I've got a question. So this time for that, if the baby's sick after it's born, for quite a while there, you actually give him the name before the actual breast?
Sometimes. Sometimes. There will be cases where I had a son that was born prematurely, and he was in the hospital for over a month. Right? So there are instances where we give a name before the bris. We can do that. The Rav's nephew was born prematurely 3 months early. So that's one of the reasons we give a name. They want to be able to pray for the baby, so they gave him a name. Ordinarily we also pray Tinok Ben. So you have to know when a baby's born that you follow the exact moment when it's near sunset, so you know which day the bris is going to be on.
There's one more point. Okay, let's move forward and we'll come back. So what's a bris milah? Okay. We should all know what the male organ looks like. So we're going to draw first the male organ the way we know it, and then we'll expand on that. Okay, so this is the male organ coming from the stomach, and this is the red cherry on top. Okay? So far, so good. Yeah, there's a slight lip. You guys might want to shift there, so you'll be able to see better. There's a slight lip that comes out, right? I exaggerated in the picture. There's the red part on top, and there's a slight lip that comes out around. So far, so good? Yes, we're all together? Okay. Now, this top part is called the atara, the crown. The red part on top is called the crown. Everyone thinks you cut that in the bris. No, you don't. That's not a bris milah. What's a bris milah? So when a baby's born, Hashem made it that there's a skin that comes from the stomach all the way up here and covers him all the way up. When you look at a baby, you don't see anything red. You see white skin coming all the way to the top. There's a hole at the top. And when he goes to the bathroom, he goes to the bathroom through that hole. Okay? That's the way what a baby looks like. What do we have to do on a bris milah? When we do circumcision, what we have to do is really cut the skin that covers that taraf from here upward. The skin that covers the red part, that skin has to be cut off. So that's what we have to do in a bris milah. What's the way to do that? So I guess we could stick in a scissors here, right, and start cutting around. That would be a little painful, right? So there's another way to do that, and that is that this skin is very flexible. Hashem made the male organ that the male organ can go from this length to this length. I mean, yeah, it can stretch. So the skin can also stretch to accommodate for that, right? So if you want, you can take this skin and pull it up. Take the skin on your hand, try to pull it. Barely goes anywhere. Take the skin on the male organ, oh, you could pull that. We all know that stretches, and that's part of the way God created us. So now what, in order to do bris milah, what we do, let's go on to picture number two. What we do is, we have the male organ here. Again, we'll exaggerate the lip a drop. And we take the outer skin and we pull it up. We grab it and pull it up. Now, the skin that was here is now pulled up. I pulled it up, right? And then I could take a knife and just cut across. And I've cut off the foreskin. Very simple. Well, what happens after the circumcision is that I've pulled this skin up and cut it, and then it looks like this after the circumcision. See this? This is cut down here.
It stays there and heals?
It stays there and heals, yeah. Now, so far so good? We're all together? Okay. Now, I want to make sure when I'm cutting the foreskin that I pulled up, that I don't hit the gland itself. So what do? I have an instrument. Well, this was sterile. Now it's not. Okay. I have an instrument that we call a magin, which is this. That when we pull up the skin, we put this here. Now what happens is the gland is under the shield, and the skin is on top. And I just cut off the skin. It's very easy. I got a straight cut too, because I'm cutting along a straight line. Okay, you guys can see it, and you'll think the slit looks very small. The truth is it's very big. You'll see that even your skin can fit in into this. A baby's skin is thinner, and it doesn't hurt the baby putting on them again. My magin. They make them thinner, but this one doesn't hurt the baby. Okay. So you guys can see this, pass it around. Just don't let it fall and pass it back. Okay, so that's step number one. So now we all understand step number one of a circumcision. Yes, we pull up the skin. In ancient times, they didn't have a magin. They'd pull up the skin. They'd feel to make sure the gland was on bottom. And then they'd cut. 1, 2, 3, now you all know how to make circumcision. I have a friend who was... his father was taken into the Russian prison for being Jewish. And in prison, he started learning about what it means to be Jewish. So he discovers there's this concept of a bris mila. So in the Russian prison, he got hold of a knife or a broken piece of glass, pulled up his own foreskin, cut it off. I have such respect for that man. I don't know how you do such a thing. What can I tell you? That's bravery. Okay, so step number one, we all understand, yeah? Now we all know step number one, how to do circumcision. Step number two. Now we'll talk a little bit about uncircumcised people and what they look like. Okay, so we saw what a child looks like. Now, God made it that we have a special skin that comes from here. We'll make a bigger picture here so we could follow the illustration. Okay. So if this is, the blue is our foreskin. So far so good? So what's to prevent dirt from coming into the body here? So what God did was God made a special skin that comes out from down here, the bottom of the lip. It goes up along here and attaches itself right by the sides of the hole. So that means that a person who's uncircumcised, the non-Jew, what he can do and what he should do when he takes a shower is stick his finger in there under the foreskin and clean it out. They don't usually do that. So when they go to the bathroom, they end up having some urine staying in here, which causes infections, which causes cancer. That's why non-Jews have cancer over here a lot, and Jews almost never, because we never have this infection. A non-Jew, a person who's uncircumcised, better know when he takes a shower, should teach kids from time they're very little, they got to stick their finger in and clean it out over there, otherwise it can be infected. So far, so good? Okay, now, feel your lip in the middle and in the top. You'll feel there's a slight skin that attaches to the middle of the lip. You guys feel that? That thickness of skin, that's about the thickness of the skin over here. Now, this skin is skin that we peel back after the circumcision. So, over here we drew how the foreskin looks after circumcision. Now let's add this layer of skin. So now after circumcision, we have this situation. The foreskin has been cut, and then there's this membrane over here. So we cut it in two and peel it back. So more accurately, the skin after circumcision, a child after circumcision looks like this. You have the part that comes out of the body. You have the foreskin that's been cut over here. You have the gland on top. And you have the skin, if we'll draw it green, that's been peeled back, meaning this skin has been cut in half and peeled back over here. You guys see it so far? Okay, so if a person will look at himself when he's in the bathroom, a person will see the following. He'll see that the skin that comes from the stomach is one color. And then there's a little line of a scab, that's where the circumcision was. And then there's another color, which is all scabbed skin. Right? This is the skin that was cut off. And then there's a third color, which is the skin that was peeled back, this skin. Meaning there are three types of skin you have over here. You guys following me? Meaning there's this skin, there's the scab of this, and there's this that dries up over here. Now, in order to save the child some pain, what we do today is before the circumcision, we take an instrument. It's really like a pin. It's really, the whole point of the instrument is that it's dull. One second. Okay. Okay. I gotta find mine. Supposed to be there. Okay, we'll continue. Here we go. Okay. This is the instrument. The whole point of it is that it's dull and it won't hurt the baby. And what we do is, you remember we said that when the child grows up, he should stick a finger inside and clean it? When the baby's born, God made it that this membrane is stuck to the gland. It's not stuck in any way that hurts. We stick this through the hole and we pass it through to separate it. Now this doesn't have to hurt the baby. What we just do is we stick it in just before the circumcision and we separate this. And what we gain by that is that when we pull the foreskin up, we've released this skin, and then the skin gets drawn up with it. So with one slice finish all, we stick this on, and we end up cutting off most of the bottom skin, all of the upper skin. And then I save the baby the need to be cut twice. You guys with me? So that's how we do it today. So, yes. There are many malls who don't do it like that. Right.
And that's why you hear sometimes they cut twice?
Even if you did it like that, sometimes you have to cut twice because when you pull up the skin, you don't have so much control of the underskin.
Right.
And sometimes more comes up and sometimes less comes up. And sometimes after you cut, you see there's a lot of skin left. And you have to cut a second time. Yeah. You don't have that much control here. What we sometimes do is we take a hemostat, that's like tweezers, and we put that in over here to hold on to that skin when we pull it up. But obviously that everyone's going like, ow, that would hurt, right? So we don't do that unless we have to. What would be a case that we have to? Sometimes a child has a very small gland. And after the circumcision, if you're going to have to start cutting around there, you got nothing to work with. It's going to be very, very hard. So sometimes you have to ensure that nothing's left of this, because if anything's going to be left, it's going to climb back up. And then in the healing, he's going to have it stuck over here and there, and that's not so nice, right? So sometimes it's not even kosher as a bris. So sometimes you have to ensure in the circumcision that you're getting all of the ora priya. So that's why sometimes a moel is going to use this at the bris. We also have surgical scissors, which can cut skin. I mean, the surgical scissors, meant to cut skin. It's very sharp. If necessary, we use it. Sometimes the build of a child is abnormal. You know, there are different builds, and then you have to do it with scissors. There can be circumcisions which have to be done with scissors. Depends on how the child's built.
You said that it's not kosher if it leaves a certain amount behind or whatever. So what defines whether it's kosher?
What defines whether it's kosher is that...
itself, the blue bit, you said, is what we're
trying
to get
off. Both of them have to come off. No, both of them. The membrane, yeah. If a person circumcised the foreskin and left the membrane, it's not a kosher bris. Yeah, both of them have to come off. Now, the membrane doesn't have to be cut off. It could be peeled back. But it cannot be left covering it. Meaning after a circumcision, all of the red part has to be showing. The definition of a circumcision is that the red part, what we defined is called, who remembers? The atara, right. The atara, all of the atara has to be revealed. Meaning you have to cut to the point where the atara is clearly revealed. Now what happens, I get a phone call the other day. Rabbi calls, he says, I teach in this and this institution. I myself did tshuva a few years ago, now I teach there, and I'm 45 years old, and I just found out that my circumcision was done in the hospital on the second day I was born, not on the eighth day. Or, my circumcision was done by a non-Jew. So then the halacha says that what we have to do is we have to do what's called a tafat damrit. We say, okay, there's nothing left to circumcise, right? Everything's revealed. So what do? You scratch the person and you get one drop of blood to come out. And that one drop we do for the sake of the mitzvah. And that one drop makes it that the whole circumcision is kosher. Now, when we do circumcision, so some mohalim use a reusable blade, which they sterilize each time. I prefer to use a surgical blade. I have an open one here somewhere. Here. No. Okay. I prefer to use a surgical blade. This blade is so sharp that when you cut with it, you don't feel it. So you guys can see it. Just don't practice because you won't feel when it's cutting. This is laser sharp stainless steel. They say it's stainless steel, but it isn't. I don't know. So that's the blade I use. You know, that's the blade they use in surgery when they have to cut open a person. Now, when I scratch the person, I do that all the time. Guys come all the time. They tell me my circumcision was done by a non-Jew before the eighth day at night in the hospital. So I do it with that only because he doesn't feel the scratch. I've been doing it for years. I don't remember the last time someone felt it. They're always telling me, no, when are you going to do it? When are you going to do it? And I say, pick up your pants. We're done. Go home. Goodbye. It's the slightest scratch, which you don't even feel. It's a that's the knife.
When you, like, if someone's converting an adult, do you just do the scratch or do the full crucifix?
So if an adult is circumcised with a kosher circumcision, and our experience is that from Australia and from most of Europe and North America, the circumcisions are usually good. From South America and Africa, the circumcisions are very problematic. I don't know who they have doing it there in South America and in Africa, but the circumcisions I see, they leave skin hanging. They leave, you can't imagine what we see. People 80 years old come in, and they got groups of skin attached to the top. Like, so that halakhically you have to fix that. But assuming he had a kosher circumcision, so then, I mean, anatomically. So then all you need is the drop of blood. So if the person is completely uncircumcised, so then we do a circumcision. In ancient times, that would be with a cup of vodka. Today, we have better anesthetics. A person does not have to be awake, but we generally do not give adults a general anesthetic for a circumcision. If they insist, we'll give it to them. But it's not necessary, and it's not healthy. It's not necessary. It doesn't sense anything. Yeah, just like Novocaine, you know. When you go to the dentist, he puts in a shot of Novocaine, you don't feel even though he's touching nerves. So by an adult, we do it in a hospital, and we do it with shots, more than one shot, all around, and for the next 6 hours, he doesn't sense anything. It's interesting that when it comes to an adult Brit Milah, so the hospitals, the urologists do it their way, and we, Mohalim, do it our way. And I teach at nights in Machon Meir, where we have a gear program, and I've accompanied many, many gerim to circumcisions, adults. And those who are done by urologists usually are incapacitated for about 2 to 3 weeks. They're lying in bed, writhing in pain. Those that are done by a moel are usually back to work that same day. So we tell them, don't go back to work that same day. Just take it easy. But by that night, the next day, we tell them take 1 or 2 days off. They're like, yeah, it hurts, but I'm okay. I'm like, they're all smiles. They come to class. You know, they come to my shiur, and I say, be gentle, guys. Take it easy. But no, the way we do it as Mohalim is as painless as can be, as near to painless as can be, to the point where there are quite a few states in the United States that research this. They put electrodes on kids, and they measured the pain that the kid goes through. And they came to the conclusion that our way of doing it, the way I described it, a bris milah by us, from the minute I touch a child, from the minute I open the diapers, to the minute I'm done and I'm bandaging him, takes anywhere between 4 and 7 seconds. That's, I mean, what do you have to do? 1, 2, 3. Finished. I just got a bandage. I'm saying that our circumcision takes a matter of seconds. In a hospital, you want to know how they do it? Yeah, you guys should know how they do it. Here's how they do it to make the doctor's life easy. They have an instrument called the clamp. What the clamp does, takes the skin and pulls it up, and then closes a clamp on it. Can you imagine taking a baby, closing a pair of pliers on the skin to ensure that he won't bleed? You got to make the doctor's life easy. You know, you don't want him dealing with a bandaging bloody baby. So they leave him with the clamp on his skin for 2 minutes. You know what it means to have any part of your body with a clamp on it for 2 minutes? A clamp that's there to stop the bleeding. And the baby's wailing his guts out. But no one cares because it's not done like we do a bris in front of everyone. It's done in an operating room. And if the doctor comes out after 15 minutes and says everything's perfect, you as the parent are happy. And so what if the baby had 2 minutes there? You don't know the difference. So I'm telling you how they do it in hospitals. They do the same thing we do, only in a much slower and more painful procedure. They lift the foreskin, They close the clam and wait 2 minutes. Now what they've achieved is that this skin is dead. You take a knife and cut it off, no bleeding, very clean breast. I could send the baby home that day. It's very efficient. I don't have to bring him back to change bandages because I killed the skin before I did it. But what's the cost? The cost is that the baby suffers like crazy. They're putting a clamp on the skin till the skin dies. And you cannot really give anesthetics to babies, even though we have a cream called Emla cream. You guys know what the size of a male organ looks like. So let me tell you what the size of a baby organ looks like when he's had Emla cream and had an allergic reaction. You see this cup? This wide. You can put two hands around it. Could you imagine? An adult doesn't have such an organ. But a baby, we see babies having allergic reactions to the cream. I'm not even talking about giving shots. But babies have a greater tendency to have allergic reactions, and we see this all the time, where parents say, no, put on, I want an anesthetic. Come on. I tell parents when I come to check the baby before the circumcision, I say, you have one piece of homework before the circumcision. I want you to listen to the baby crying when you change a diaper. Because what usually happens is you never listen to a baby crying until the bris milah. And then the seconds seem to drag on. It's like, oh boy, he's suffering terrible. So I say, you do me a favor. You listen when you change a diaper. And you tell me if he cries more when you change his diaper or when I do the circumcision. And every parent admits that he cries more when they change a diaper than when I do the circumcision. Because the only difference is that on the circumcision, you're listening, and every second is agony. You can only imagine what the poor kid is suffering. But now you guys know that the suffering is really a split second. You come across with that knife, he doesn't even feel it. You bandage him, gemarnu. You put a little wine in his mouth, you finished. No, I'm saying the kids are calm. What's there to cry about? There's really only a split second that you're cutting him. So then afterwards, he has a wound that has to heal, and it's a tiny wound. We bandage the baby. Some people put on some creams to help it. Generally, the most important thing is to put an antiseptic cream to prevent infection. And then we have a tradition that there's one more thing which we have to do, which is to ensure that there's adequate blood supply to the place that's healing. So in ancient times, they used to put their mouth on it and suck and ensure that blood was flowing to the place. That's what's called mitzitza. Today what I do is I take a sterile syringe. I pull out the syringe from the plastic. I put in gauze pads in the plastic. And I put the plastic over the baby. And then I suck out for a second. And then you ensure that the blood is flowing to the place. Technically, medically, there's big discussion about why we have to do this. If you don't do it to a child, I mean, in the hospitals, they don't do it. And children generally heal properly. But there are those children who are built anatomically slightly differently, where the difference of ensuring adequate blood supply or not can be the difference between proper healing and not. So although technically you're right, you can do it without it, and we see thousands of children live without it, but we also see that there are those instances which you won't know in advance where this can make the difference. So we do mitzitza, but what you guys will see is that the mo'al usually takes this and does it with this. There are still those mo'alim who do it with their mouth, and you know what? What? Some do and some don't. It depends on the community. Right. There was an ancient tradition to also take wine, spit it out on the area. That's like a local anesthetic, and then suck out. But at the end of the day, you can discuss it with your mom. And I had a bris once where I came to do the bris. And as I'm setting up the chair, someone comes over to me. Turns out it was just a nut in the shul, but I didn't know that at the time. He walks over to me and he says, in this shul, we do mitzitza b'peh. We suck with the mouth. So I said, really? It's so good you told me a half hour before the bris. I'll get you another moil. I'm not doing it. Now, I went to the parents. I said, if that's the custom in the shul, you'll get someone else. I'm not... There are a lot of mohalim who will do it. But, you know, I prefer not to do it. I do it with this. And the parents said, no, he's a nutcase. What are you listening to him for? He's not a rabbi. Here he's nothing. What do I know? A guy walks over with a long white beard. He tells me that's what we do in this shul. I say, okay, I'll get you someone else. I'm not doing it. But there are both customs. No. But then you could also use a bigger syringe. Technically, the Chassam Sofer and others write that any action that ensures that there's adequate blood supply, meaning if you take a gauze pad and squeeze it, you're also ensuring that blood is coming out, You're ensuring that there's blood supply. That's also technically okay. We do it the traditional way. This is closer to the traditional way than just taking a gauze pad and squeezing. But technically, the actual bandaging is also good when we ensure that blood is coming out. Okay, we have 5 minutes, and now is your turn for questions. Yeah?
Is blood not kosher?
Blood is not kosher. You spit it out. You don't swallow it. Yeah, no one swallows it. What other questions?
Hard question. Would it be considered, or could it be considered, if it wasn't commanded by God, or if you looked at it in a certain way, couldn't a Brit Mila be considered a willful mutilation of the human body, even if, and especially without the baby's consent? The baby can't say, I definitely want this procedure to be done to me.
I agree. If God wouldn't say it, I wouldn't do it.
Okay.
Even though there are medical benefits, and we haven't yet discussed the medical benefits, maybe we'll get to that. We discussed one medical benefit. As far as AIDS, we'll, maybe we'll get a chance to discuss, we should discuss that. But I'm telling you, if I didn't have a mitzvah from God, if it wasn't a covenant between us and Him, I wouldn't do it. But I do it, because I have a mitzvah. I agree with you. Okay. If God didn't tell me to do it, you know what, I wouldn't do a million things. I don't know if I'd wake up in the morning. Bed is more pleasant than getting out of bed.
Why is it for me that done? I know it's not in all cases, but why is it done most of the time in a shul, or in a place with a lot of people, and not in a hospital, or in surgery, or in a place with the necessary instruments in case something goes wrong?
So you have to factor that you have thousands of Brit Milot being done every day. Every so often, a child does have to be taken to the hospital, but 99.999% of the time, he doesn't, right? So we celebrate the mitzvah. If a person wanted to do it in the hospital, he could. The hospitals do have facilities here in Israel to do it there if you wanted to. I think it's an unnecessary precaution, because even when it's necessary, so you get in the car and you go there. Nothing happens that necessitates, in a normal circumstance, nothing is there that would necessitate intervention within 1 second. You know, it's not like that's what we're dealing with here. Even let's say an artery were cut. Let's say you can hold the artery closed till you get to the hospital. I'm saying even if the hospital were 20 minutes away or half an hour away. I'm saying even in a worst case scenario. I'm saying there's nothing really there that should necessitate a hospital being close by. Technically, a bris milah should be done in a hall where you could celebrate it afterwards, being that it is more convenient in a shul where people are already there for davening. So out of respect for the congregation, we allow this leniency of doing a bris in a shul. Really, we wouldn't use a shul as a hall. A shul isn't supposed to be a hall. Just like we don't make weddings in a hall, we wouldn't do a bris milah in a shul. But because the congregation is already congregated in the shul, so in order to prevent extra work, everyone's going to have to travel to the hall, so the rabbis allowed this leniency of doing a bris milah in the shul. People sometimes think you have to do bris milah in the shul. They call a bris milah for 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and they say in the shul. What for? That's wrong. The whole idea is if you're already there because you davened, you have the whole congregation there. So we'll allow the leniency of doing it in the shul in order not to make everyone have to travel somewhere else. But you don't bring everyone to the shul to make a bris milah there. Meaning if they're not already there, the question is what hall to do it in, so choose a hall and do it in a hall. You with me? Okay. What else? Good questions. Guys, what else? Yeah.
Has there been any research done on the difference between the functionality of the male organ in adults that have been circumcised and haven't been circumcised?
Yes.
If they've been circumcised, when they're an adult, has there been research done about the functionality?
Yeah, the research points that a circumcision is a healthy thing to do. But you can look it up online. There are a lot of articles that have been written about the medical benefits of a circumcision.
Okay.
The only claim against the circumcision, the only realistic claim, is that when you have less skin, you have less pleasure. The fact of the matter is that God gave us this skin, and this skin, a person who has more skin in that place, a non-Jew is going to have more pleasure, more pleasure. Because he just tactile. I mean, there's more skin there. There's more cells. There's more sensory input. So that's the only big difference. And we say that that's a positive thing. That it's not easy to control our desire for promiscuity. And believe me, I spoke to people. I was curious to follow this up. So I spoke to adults who were married for 20 years before the circumcision and 20 years after. You know, I spoke to my students who did circumcision, and I said, you know, the halacha discusses, meaning before the research, Maimonides already wrote almost 1,000 years ago, that the circumcision reduces a certain element of pleasure, and it's a positive thing. So I asked them if they sense it, and I haven't yet found one who on a personal level felt that difference. Meaning logically, medically, and the research points that there should be a difference. A guy who's uncircumcised should have more pleasure than a guy who is circumcised. That's the logic. But speaking to people, they didn't feel that way. Having spoken to people who were adults in both stages. But I'm not saying it's not that way. I'm just saying, fine. Now, what about AIDS? So let's just cover that for a second. In a nutshell, when an uncircumcised person has an erection, what happens is that the gland protrudes through both skins, and the skins peel back. And then there are slight severs in the skin as it protrudes through here. And that's why a person who's circumcised, so then there's nothing to protrude through the skin. So you reduce the chance of getting AIDS by 90%. You still have a 10% chance. And a person who has AIDS, a person's going to live with a woman who has AIDS, so then if he lived with her 10 times, so if he's circumcised, his chances that in one of those times he'll get AIDS. If he's uncircumcised, then he has a much greater chance of contracting AIDS. People think that a circumcision, if you're circumcised, you can't contract AIDS. That's not true. The circumcision simply reduces the odds, meaning if until now the odds were every time a person has relations with a woman who has AIDS that he's gonna get AIDS, let's say a 70% chance, so now it's down to a 10% chance. But if a guy is going to be promiscuous, he's going to get AIDS. It's not like circumcision is a protection against AIDS, it just reduces the odds. Now that reduction is so substantial that the UN, about 3-4 years ago, the UN funded for the circumcision of a few million people in Africa to help prevent the spread of AIDS. Now, again, it's not really going to prevent it. It's just going to reduce the odds on every given time. So that's enough that it was worth it for the UN. But a person shouldn't think that because he's circumcised, he can't contract AIDS. He could. What else? South Africa, yeah. What else? Gentlemen, any other questions?
Yeah, what do you mean by if you're circumcised, you're less likely to contract AIDS? That doesn't make sense with the way you describe protruding with an erection. Does that mean?
It's a longer explanation. I would really have to draw it, and that I didn't have time. In previous classes, I drew it. If I drew it, you'd understand it better. But let's leave that for now. Any other questions? Just take my word for it.
Okay.
We don't understand anatomically, but science says it. We could believe them. Yeah.
You said that you said that in hospitals they don't always suck out the blood or anything like that.
Correct.
And you said sometimes it says that if you didn't suck it out, that it can
heal badly,
right? And then what does it mean, heal badly? What does that mean? Like what?
It depends on which, you know, that you're talking about unusual cases. When the Talmud says to suck out the blood, the Talmud also says that it's an interesting line in Talmud. The Talmud says, if you have a mohel who doesn't do it, remove him from his post. Now, think logically. If it was 1 plus 1 equals 2, when he circumcises, doesn't suck the blood, the kids drop dead, they don't heal well, I didn't need the Talmud to tell me don't use him, right? So then obviously by the Talmud telling me that, what the Talmud was telling me is, at first glance, you're not going to notice anything wrong with the kids that he circumcises. That's why the Talmud and the Shulchan Aruch has to tell me, if he doesn't do it, remove him from his post. Because I wouldn't know it on my own. It's not an obvious problem. So then the commentaries all have a big discussion. Wait a second, so what's this non-obvious problem that we're trying to heal? So some want to say it's hypospadias or epospadias, or there are different abnormalities in the build of the gland. And those abnormalities, meaning you have some children, even though they look like they're built normally, they actually urinate from here. They have a slight little hole and it comes out of there. That's called hypospadias, depending on if it's on top or bottom. Hypospadias, hypospadias. But and then there are degrees, 1, 2, 3. Now you understand that if the whole build is warped, so then the veins can also be built in a warped way. There can be a situation where adequate blood supply in order to heal the area is not a given. A normal child, it's a given. So which abnormality were Chazal referring to where they said, you won't notice it at first glance, but you should know, don't leave such a mohel to work. Don't let him work. So Chazal, we're talking about something which is rare. So the commentaries discuss which exact rare condition it is. That's a little bit hard to know. What we do know is that at first glance, everything's going to seem okay. So the hospitals, of course, will tell you, look, we're doing it. All the kids are okay. And every so often, you always have problems. So we don't know which of those problems would have been prevented had they done it, because the Talmud tells me it's to prevent a rare case, but you're saving a certain kid. There are going to be kids where this is all the difference. Which kids? So that's a question of research. Okay, anything else? Guys, I'll give you my card. If you ever have a situation where you have questions, you're welcome to contact me. You have my email. It's hard to catch me by phone. I didn't come prepared to give out cards, so I only have three. The rest of you, you can have. You guys can. I'll give your madrich for tomorrow. I give information free of charge, and when necessary, I do circumcisions free of charge. Ordinarily, a moel it should be paid. I'm unusual, but you guys should pay a moel. It takes a certain risk. The moel took a certain amount of training, and he is taking a certain responsibility. You owe it to him. He's taking of his time. He's taking of the care of your children. The right thing is to give him a nice paycheck. Pay him correctly. If the reason that a person is hesitant to do circumcision is because it's expensive, so you should know, I know hundreds of mohalim that will do bris for free. I always do it for free, but there are many other people who do it for free always and will also accommodate for free. If you know someone that needs a tefat tambrit, that their circumcision was not kosher, so send them to me and tell them I do it free of charge, and I'll set them up. I'm happy to help whoever needs. We had here a lot of guys who came with the groups who found out that their circumcisions were done either in the hospital before the eighth day or at night or by a non-Jew or someone who didn't keep Torah and mitzvot. And in 1 second, the situation was fixed. And again, I don't remember the last time anyone felt anything. It's not something that's painful. It's simple and easy. But people sometimes are very scared of the idea. People can spend years of their life living there thinking, you know, I should be doing this, but I'm not. So here you have an opportunity. You let me know. I can do it the same day. You know, in a matter of 5 minutes, it could be behind you. It takes 1 second and there's no healing. There's nothing. It's a scratch. You know, you don't even see it a second later. I'll give you the cards. You'll have my email. And those of you who didn't get cards, you're sure I'll give you. Who wants one? Now, I also have a website. I also have a website where I put classes, audio classes of this. And we have 7,000-8,000 classes on there, many, many Jewish stories, many topics, questions and answers, basic Jewish questions. If you're interested, you have the website here. It's called Torah for Me. Or if that's hard to remember, 123Torah.com will get you the same place. Okay. I don't know if I have any more. Okay, Yisher Koch, you guys had excellent questions and it was a pleasure. I have another two here for another one. Who else wants one? You? Colin? Whatever. Okay. Top.